Gentlemen, our first case for this morning is in the matter of Goldblatt's Organ Stores. Mr. Whitman.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey Whitman. I am here with my partner Brian Shaw on behalf of the appellant Great American Group. Great American Group appeals the judgment of the district court's reversal of a judgment entered in favor of Great American by the bankruptcy court in early 2003 against LaSalle in the amount of $1,086,000. Great American appeals this reversal on five specific bases. First, we contend that the district court improperly conducted a de novo review of the facts, which would have facts that Judge Weedoff had ruled on in Great American's favor. Second, compounding this error, the district court, when it reviewed these facts, did not apply a clear error standard as it was required to do. Third, the district court, in ruling that there was fraud on the part of Great American, made this ruling without ruling that Great American had that LaSalle had clearly and convincingly established this fraud. Fourth, the district court completely ignored the requirement to prove damages in connection with this fraud. And then fifth, it erroneously found that the bankruptcy court had ruled Great American had fraudulently induced LaSalle, which it didn't. And it is these five arguments that form the basis for this appeal. Great American was hired.
There are also two jurisdictional issues that have been raised, and I think you will want to address them.
The two jurisdictional issues, Your Honor, the first is the question of whether the order entered by Judge Coral was final and appealable. And we believe it was. The court did say it remanded the matter back to the bankruptcy court, but the remand, it is entirely unclear as to what the remand is for. There are no further proceedings, no further issues, no further issues for the bankruptcy court to decide. All the district court order did, was reverse the judgment in favor of Great American and ruled that LaSalle didn't have to return the overpayment at issue. Under the well-settled law that we've cited in our briefs, if a remand is for a purely ministerial act, then it is considered final and appealable. Here, there's not even a ministerial act for the bankruptcy court to perform. It was the reversal of a judgment. The court said, LaSalle, you get to keep the overpayment. You're not required to return it to Great American. So we think this was a final and appealable order. It was clearly ministerial, if there is anything for even the bankruptcy court to do. In terms of the arguments raised by LaSalle, these are real red herrings. These were issues that were never raised before the bankruptcy court. There's no impact on other claimants that the court needs to decide. There was a settlement agreement that had been entered into between the trustee and Great American, agreement that was approved by the bankruptcy court. There was a judgment against the trustee, which was never appealed by LaSalle or the trustee. And the equitable subordination argument they raise is out of thin air. Nobody has ever pled that Great American's security interest was subject to equitable subordination. They fabricated these arguments. They were never raised before the bankruptcy court, and therefore we think this was a final and appealable order. The second jurisdictional issue relates to subject matter jurisdiction, and we believe that the court clearly does have subject matter jurisdiction as a core proceeding under 28 U.S.C. 157. The adversary proceeding that the trustee initiated sought to determine the extent, validity, and priority of two parties, LaSalle and Great American's liens on property of the estate, and that's the important issue here. This was a dispute over property of the estate. The ruling affects the allocation of property of the estate. If Great American is entitled to keep, or If Great American is entitled to a return of this, then it it no longer has to seek its administrative claim against the estate, which it was allowed back in 2003. The case here is solely about proceeds which are property of the estate. And the money here, the case is distinguishable from all the cases that have been cited by LaSalle because none of those cases involve cross-claims between parties which solely relate to property of the estate. So we think there is subject matter jurisdiction for that reason. Now, with respect to Judge Kaur's ruling, as I stated earlier, we believe that there was an improper de novo review of the facts. Clearly, findings of fact are reviewed for clear error. They're not reviewed on a de novo basis. And in reversing Judge Weedoff, the district court took a look at the testimony and the evidence presented by LaSalle that the bankruptcy court had rejected and soundly rejected in during closing arguments and in ruling in Great American's favor. And the district court said, wait a second, we think LaSalle did present evidence that it would have acted differently with respect to the transfer, had it known about these transfers at issue. We think that this would have produced a physical inventory which might have caused them to liquidate their collateral in a different method. Therefore, the bankruptcy court could have made that finding. That's what Judge Corey said. He said the bankruptcy court could have made the finding. Therefore, I'm reversing. Well, the point is the bankruptcy court didn't make that finding. The bankruptcy court said you failed to show how you would have acted any differently. You failed to show damages, and therefore you failed to show that you were fraudulently induced into entering into this agreement at issue. Therefore, I am granting judgment in favor of Great American Group. What Judge Gore did was completely improper. He said, I look at the evidence differently. But he compounded this error by failing to say the bankruptcy court clearly erred in its findings of fact. And that's what he had to do in order to reverse Judge Weedoff. The district court was required to review the findings of fact for clear error, and it did not do so. It simply said the bankruptcy court could have reached an opposite conclusion. The point is, it didn't. On top of that, the court ruled that LaSalle had established its affirmative defense of fraudulent inducement without having to prove clear and convincingly that it did so. Clearly, in order to prove fraudulent inducement, you have to establish a statement or omission of a material fact with intent by the party making it to have the other party rely on it, reliance, as well as damages. And you have to prove all of those elements by clear and convincing evidence. District court made no such finding. Instead, it found they might have done things differently. That falls really far short of the standard that the law requires to prove fraud. The other problem with its finding on the fraudulent inducement affirmative defense is the judge's very curious ruling that LaSalle did not need to prove damages. And the district court reasoned that because fraudulent inducement was pled as an affirmative defense by LaSalle and not as a substantive cause of action, it was excused from its obligation to prove damages. Clearly erroneous.
Has LaSalle ever asked to be excused from the entire contract and to have everything rewound to where it would have been had there been no contract?
Well,
that's the normal remedy for fraud in the inducement.
It is. And here they're making the argument that they should not be bound by the contract, but you can't...
Well, they're making the argument, as I understand it, that they get the benefits of the contract, but they don't have to comply with any detrimental clauses.
Exactly.
The question I'm asking is whether LaSalle has ever asked to be relieved of the entire contract, and both sides will make restitution to put themselves back in the position that they would be in as if the contract had never been entered into.
They haven't made that request because they can't make that request. And the reason they can't...
Well, they can, but I just wanted to know whether they had.
They have not because...
Your position might be that if they made it, it should be rejected, but they can certainly make it.
Well, the problem with that for LaSalle is that they were paid $2.5 million on this contract. They're not about to return all of that money.
Look, if there were... If the contract were treated as void, they would have to. You may be saying that they haven't made this argument, and there's a good reason why they haven't. I was just trying to figure out whether they had made it or not.
They have not, and...
Of course, you would have to restore all the inventory.
Yeah, it would be impossible. We're in a legal no-man's land.
You can buy a lot of cheap inventory.
Not the inventory that was actually sold, though. And that's problematic, obviously. But with respect to the damages... the law is clear. They have to prove damages on a fraudulent inducement claim, even as it's an affirmative defense. And the district court reasoned that, and they cite the Chicago Park District case for this proposition, and it doesn't stand for this proposition, that they are not bound by this contract and they don't need to prove damages in order to carry the day on their fraudulent inducement claim. Compounding this error, the practical effect of the district court's ruling is that it awarded LaSalle damages by allowing it to hold on to this $1.1 million. The court viewed this as not a damage claim because they already possessed the overpayment. But that's incorrect. The overpayment is Great American's. And if they're allowed to keep it, it would merely act as a set-off to the breach of contract claim and the unjust enrichment claims and the conversion claim that Great American prevailed on before the bankruptcy court. So if the judgment is allowed to stand, they've been awarded these $1.1 million in damages. The final point of error that we allege deals with the fraudulent inducement finding, and we believe there are multiple errors in this regard. Number one, the court... the district court in its ruling made several incorrect statements. First, it ruled that LaSalle had presented evidence that it would have acted differently. And this goes back to the de novo review. Judge Weedoff clearly rejected this, and in his ruling in Great American's favor said there was no evidence it would have acted differently. So the bankruptcy court clearly rejected this evidence, and there was no finding of fraudulent inducement. Second problem is the finding that the bankruptcy court could reasonably have found there was a fraudulent inducement. Again, the bankruptcy court didn't make this finding, and LaSalle, throughout its brief, says the bankruptcy court ruled fraudulent inducement. The bankruptcy court ruled there was fraudulent inducement. The bankruptcy court ruled there was no fraudulent inducement. The bankruptcy court could not have been more clear that this was not a case of fraudulent inducement. The next error relates to the district court's statement that Great American knew that the transfers between these stores significantly decreased the value of the stated inventory. That's simply incorrect. There was uncontradicted testimony by Tom Pabst of Great American who stated, A, he didn't know what was being reported to LaSalle, and B, it was his belief that the stated inventory levels as reported to Great American by Goldblatt's had already accounted for these transfers. That was the only evidence on this issue, and it was clearly erroneous for both the bankruptcy court and the district court to rule that there was a duty to disclose the existence of these transfers for the very reason that there was no evidence that Great American knew that the transfers constituted a material fact, meaning the Great American didn't know that it had adversely affected the reported inventory levels to LaSalle. There was no intent there.
That goes more to intent.
There was no intent by Great American. They didn't know what LaSalle knew, and they believed that, again, that the transfers had been accounted for in the reported inventory levels.
Right, but that doesn't affect the duty to disclose analysis. It really goes to whether there's sufficient proof of the required state of mind here.
I would submit that The duty to disclose only arises when you have knowledge of a material fact.
Well, and, he knew about the transfers.
Right. But if Mr. Papp's intent was, or his state of mind was such that he thought that the transfers had already accounted, had been accounted for in the reported inventory levels, and the reported inventory levels were within or above the range that was required under the February agency agreement, then it wouldn't constitute a material fact in his mind. And I guess it ties in with intent, like you said, Judge. But the other reason that the bankruptcy, that the district court erred in its finding regarding the fraudulent inducement was it stated that for reasons unclear to it, the bankruptcy court ruled in Great American's favor, despite its finding that there was fraudulent inducement. The district court's opinion states on its face that the bankruptcy court found there was a fraudulent inducement. And as I stated earlier, that's simply incorrect. Judge Weedoff was very clear. He relied heavily on this court's ruling in FDIC versus W.R. Grace that there were multiple components of a fraudulent inducement claim that were missing, mainly damages, but also reliance. The court was clear that they failed to show any reliance, that it would have acted any differently, and therefore we ask that the district court's ruling be reversed.
Well, Judge Weedoff did say that he thought there had been a fraudulent failure to disclose, which isn't the full cause of action.
Correct.
But maybe that's where some of the...
And that's what LaSalle hangs its hat on, is this really unfortunate statement of the word fraudulent. He says this in a very offhand manner in denying our claim for prejudgment interest. And he says, oh, one other thing. Because I did find there was a fraudulent failure to disclose, I think prejudgment interest is inappropriate. He later, well, first of all, that only relates to the duty to disclose. He did not find there was fraudulent inducement as a whole, number one. Number two, he clarified that remark in August of 2004 when Goldblatt's principals had filed a motion to dismiss this action. And they made the motion on the basis of this alleged fraudulent inducement finding, and the judge says, no, that completely mischaracterizes my prior finding. I did not find there was a fraudulent inducement. And for those reasons, we ask that the judgment... that the district court's reversal be in and of itself reversed and that the bankruptcy court's judgment be reinstated.
Thank you very much, counsel. Ms. Newman.
May it please the court. LaSalle, a party guilty of fraudulent inducement should not be allowed to enforce a contract against it.
That's certainly a straightforward proposition, but the usual consequence is that one unravels the entire contract and goes back with restitution on both sides. Is that a remedy you've requested?
No, Your Honor.
If you're not asking for the fraudulent inducement remedy, the question is, why are you entitled to keep the benefits of the contract while avoiding the detriments?
Your Honor, we're asserting it as an affirmative defense, not as a affirmative cause of action. The problem is we've had the sale.
Look, counsel, the rule, if I understand correctly, is if you don't want out of the entire contract, if you don't want a rescissionary remedy, which you say you don't want, then the rule is you have to show not only a fraudulent inducement, that is transaction causation, but also loss causation. And you seem to be saying you're entitled to prevail by showing transaction causation, but not loss causation. That would be a substantial change in the law, as I understand it.
Well, Your Honor, the problem is the horse is out of the barn. The liquidation sales of the Goldblatt stores has already been conducted. So we cannot go back and unravel that.
And rescissionary remedies in contract are very common. They often require proxies or best estimates. But you can't say, well, gee, it's hard to have a rescissionary remedy, therefore we get this asymmetric remedy in which we keep all the benefits without making restitution, and the other side loses.
we're not keeping all of the benefits. They benefited as well. But, Your Honor, the point is, why should Great American Group be able to profit from their failure to disclose to the bank exactly what was going on with our collateral? This was our collateral. We subordinated our interest. We put our trust in this company to liquidate the collateral. And then we find out after the fact, after the stores have been liquidated, that there was movement of the inventory. Essentially, what you're saying is that a party can sit back, a party under FDIC, which is in a greater has greater knowledge, greater ability to determine the facts. This is their business. They had greater knowledge of what was going on from the inventory than a bank.
Look, counsel, that may all be true. But I began this by stating what my understanding of the law is. It's certainly the law of the Supreme Court reflected in cases like Dura Pharmaceuticals against Brudo. I think, as best I can understand it, it's the law of Illinois that one must show, if you're not asking for a rescission, one must show loss causation. And that's what's troubling me, because you seem to say we either can't show it or just don't want to show it.
Well, there are actually usually two remedies for a fraudulently induced contract. Number one, there's rescission, and both parties need to be put back to where they were. And then the other is you can affirm the contract and ask for damages. In a way...
And that's when you have to show loss causation. That's my question. You're not saying we've shown loss causation. You seem to be saying we don't need to.
Well, we did... There was testimony that the bank would have acted differently. Had they known about the movement of inventory, the very first one is they probably would have conducted their own inventory of their own assessment of the inventory. Second, they said that they never would have entered into the agreement itself. They never would have entered into. They were looking at other liquidators. Hilco possibly could have liquidated the inventory.
That's an argument for a rescissionary remedy, but you say you're not making it.
What you're actually asking for is partial avoidance of the contract, and the general rule is you can't get partial avoidance of a contract.
Well, I also don't think that a party should be able to profit. There is case law that says a party should not be able to profit
That's
from their fraud.
That's just a general equitable principle. You're really not addressing the remedies question that the Chief Judge is asking here, and it is a remedies question. And the remedies law is against you on this. You can't get partial rescission, except in some very unusual circumstances that aren't applicable here.
I submit that the wrongdoer should not be rewarded for what they...
Well,
for
it's
what
not a reward. You're sitting on a windfall right now.
Not necessarily. We don't... They never provided the bank with a complete accounting, okay? They had a contractual obligation to give us a complete accounting of all of the sales. They didn't do that. And it was, since they didn't do that, it was very hard to determine how much exactly we're talking about here. On the other hand, they knew, the problem is, the so-called shortfall was $500,000. They knew about the $500,000, and now they're saying, we overpaid you. Isn't that kind of like, you know, the orphan crying to the court because they murdered their parents? I mean, they were the ones who knew about the transfer of the inventory, and they didn't say anything. And what's interesting is the contract itself defines this. The contract itself says inventory should not be transferred outside of the ordinary course of business, and we had an admission from Great American that essentially said anything more than $100,000 worth of transfers is outside of the ordinary course of business. So now we have an amount, the $475,000 worth of transfers. They knew there was going to be a shortfall, and now they're saying, well, now we want it back. That does not strike me as equitable, as fair, and also they should not benefit from this bargain that they created. They created the situation, and they should not be allowed to benefit from it. I'd like to address a couple other issues. In terms of finality, actually, we'd like to concede that issue. The district, you know, whether or not the district court's order was final and whether this court has appellate jurisdiction, we'll concede that. We saw in the response, the reply brief, that they are not going to assert this as a defense or prevent Great American from using liquidation of its claim in a preclusive.
One can concede a jurisdictional issue.
But
you can, of course, say you agree with their analysis.
Okay. However, we do not agree with subject matter jurisdiction. And subject matter jurisdiction, we believe that the bankruptcy court did not have subject matter jurisdiction because this was a dispute, essentially a dispute between two creditors. The cross claims have to have their own independent jurisdictional basis.
The argument, as I understand it, is that this is within subject matter jurisdiction because it's under the related to jurisdiction. And it's within the related to jurisdiction because how much is collected from the bank affects how much the trustee pays and therefore how much the other creditors get. Now, that's a pretty straightforward argument, is it? Do you disagree with it on factual grounds or on legal grounds?
On legal grounds, Your Honor. I don't believe that there's related to jurisdiction because I don't believe that whether or not a third party has a claim against the estate confers jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court or how much of that claim. It's whether there was property. Now,
did you challenge that at the bankruptcy court?
I believe we did. Yes. We filed an abstention motion. We did challenge, and Judge Weedoff said that he believed that he had jurisdiction. So at the onset, we did. We believe that there's no related to jurisdiction because the
did you raise that again at the district court?
I think we did. I don't recall, actually, Your Honor. I know that we raised it here. I know that we raised it in the trial court. The question is, was this property of the estate? The money would have belonged to either Great American Group or LaSalle Bank. We wouldn't be here if that wasn't what the issue was. So that is not arising under Chapter 11. So there's no direct jurisdiction. There's no related to jurisdiction because it's essentially, as an in re Zionix, this is a dispute that is really between two creditors and not between the debtor and another creditor. Great American Group argues that the district court used an improper standard of review, that he used an improper de novo review of the facts, and we don't believe that that's the case. The district court looked at facts to support Judge Weedoff's finding that there was a fraudulent inducement, that there were certain elements of a fraudulent inducement, that there was, first of all, whether or not there was a duty to disclose. We believe there is a duty to disclose because it was in the contract. They were required to let us know if there was inventory being transferred back and forth between the two stores. Was it material? Judge Weedoff thought it was material, and Judge Kaur thought it was material. Of course, it was $500,000 worth of merchandise going back and forth. And the main reason it was material is it made the first six.
Just lead us to a damages calculation. Assume the $500,000 of inventory had remained at the four February stores, and other things had happened as they happened. Great American would have made less money on the sales from the two January stores and more money on the sales from the February stores, and that would have affected the bank's share, too. What would the effect on the bank's share have been with that reallocation?
The testimony was that...
I'm not asking about testimony. This is a matter of just applying the contract terms, which specify how much Great American gets and how much the bank gets from sales at the particular location. So assume they sell 500,000 less at the January stores and 500,000 more at the February stores. What happens under the contract?
Well, we would not have entered into the contract if...
No, just answer my question.
What would have happened differently?
What do the contract terms provide about that circumstance?
Well, there was no overfunded amount in the January... under the January contract, Your Honor, I'm trying to answer. The January contract... we probably would have been less. There probably would have been less money because there was less of a sale.
Yes, I can figure out the signs on the variables, less and more. If the answer is you don't know, that would be fine. But I would think that that's the calculation one needed to perform long ago in this litigation in order to figure out actual damages, actual injury.
Ms. Newman, at some point, LaSalle uses a $377,000 set-off figure. Where does that come from? How's that calculated?
The $300,000 set-off figure?
$377,000 or some figure like that.
We had, computers that were sold. There was fixtures that, according to the contract, I think...
So that's not based on the inventory sales?
I don't believe so. The Great American Group also sold fixtures, and as I recall, that might have been why that number came up. I believe that under the FDIC case decided by this court was that an omission, there was a fraudulent omission of a material fact. It was material because it was there was a lot of inventory. It was $500,000. Judge Weedoff found that it was. Judge Kaur found that it was material, that they did have a duty to tell us about it. And I don't think that Great American Group should be able to profit from this transaction. The bank had a meeting in February what they were going to do prior to liquidation of the last four stores. They were discussing other options. They were discussing an assignment for a benefit of creditors. They were discussing maybe having Hilco do the liquidation for them. Why should Great American Group be rewarded by artificially inflating the first set of stores so they can't?
Evidence show that you would have yielded from those other methods?
Pardon me?
What did your evidence show that LaSalle would have recovered from those other methods?
Well,
I guess I ask it because I suggest the record says nothing about that.
Well, the record does say that the bank wouldn't have continued to lend at those levels. It decreased the bank's borrowing base. They would not have, if they had known what the real levels were. It was the borrowing base had to be, the money that the bank was putting out was commensurate with whatever our collateral was. And if the collateral wasn't there, there's testimony that they wouldn't have lent at the levels that they lent to Goblatz. And the problem is, again, in assessing damages, is that the sales have already been conducted. So we have a unique situation where we have partial performance, not complete performance, because they never provided us with an accounting of what happened, how much, what their profit was, even though the contract said they were required to do that. I ask that Your Honors affirm Judge Kaur's finding, because he did not want to reward wrongdoing, and that the $500,000 transfer was material to how we would have behaved and what we would have done differently. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. Anything further, Mr. Widman?
To answer the court's question, LaSalle did file a motion to dismiss the matter for subject matter jurisdiction before the district court. Judge Court denied that motion, ruling that there was not only related to jurisdiction, but also core jurisdiction as well. To answer another question, the evidence showed that LaSalle flatly conceded that they were unable to prove damages. Mr. Chapman, in closing arguments, conceded this, saying, we can't show damages. We simply are asserting that we would not have lent, continued to lend. And again, that argument was flatly rejected by Judge Weedoff, who said, well, but so what? If you had stopped lending, there would have been an immediate shutdown of the stores, no ability to orderly liquidate the inventory, and no evidence that it would have produced any greater returns for you. With respect to damages or profits, excuse me, there was absolutely no evidence that Great American profited in any way. Judge Weedoff made this ruling. The record has no evidence that there was profit at all. There was also no evidence that Great American knew that the transfer, as I stated earlier, affected the accounting as reported by Goldblatt's. And I believe... and the last point is with respect to choosing another liquidator. The testimony at the trial was they conceded they had absolutely no say in choosing the liquidator. They're claiming, well, we could have brought in Hilco, they're a competitor of Great Americans. Mr. Etienne said, actually, we agree. We had no ability as the lender to choose who the liquidator was. So those are my only points. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.